Gary Gulman. Gary is a comedian. He's been making audiences laugh for decades. But things have not always been a laugh riot. There have been some tough times along the way. A few years ago, Gary was forced to move back into his mother's home in Boston in an attempt to deal with his depression and anxiety. But he's turned his life around since then. Now Gary revisits his mother's house and his entire youth for the very funny and moving memoir, Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s. I can relate. I'm still awkward in the 2020s. Gary uses his incredible memory to share some very funny stories about his childhood and his adult life. He reminisces about fumbling in his first big football game, attending Hebrew school, and calling out his nemesis at Jewish summer camp. Gary also shares the insights he learned about battling depression. And Gary being Gary, he also had some fun with the book. For example, he wrote an introduction to the introduction.
I have sort of a compulsion or a ritual of reading the intro, the preface, or the foreword, and that I will not start after it. I will not do anything before it. And I've gotten a lot out of reading those. I read it was kind of a new foreword or preface to an edition of The Grapes of Wrath, and reading it was just as important as reading the body of the book, the actual book, and was really helpful. And so I've always been insistent on this, and I wanted to call out people who don't read the intros and then tell you that they read the book. So it was sort of a thing where I was teasing people about their not reading the intro and skipping forward and cutting corners, but also I wanted to reinforce how important it was in my case to read the introduction.
Mm-hmm. I think, of course, it depends on the introduction, but I think in anyone's case, it is important to read the introduction. And I have this kind of, I have OCD, so I have this thing where I read something, I insist that I have to read the introduction and preface, yes, and whatever. And I'm wondering, did you ever consider writing an epilogue and an epilogue to the epilogue?
I didn't consider that, but now I wish I had, because that is a really great idea. It's sort of that I remember early in my life, people would write letters to each other, and they would put PS and then PSS and PSSSS, and I always found that really, really funny and clever, and I it's a missed opportunity, but you're a very clever person.
Well, thank you. That means a lot coming from such a clever, funny person as yourself. Thank you. I got to get that tattooed on my arm. But you could still do it when the paperback comes out.
Oh, that's, you know what? That's a great idea, because there are adjustments made to paperbacks, and I will definitely partake in that.
Cool. Excellent. You devote entire chapters to each year of your education, all the way from kindergarten to the 12th grade. And I'm just astonished at all the details you remembered. How were you able to remember all these details?
It was a combination of things. One thing was that I have this habit over the years, and probably started as soon as I became conscious, was knowing there were things, events that I would never forget, and frequently commenting on it either in my head or aloud. I would say, oh, I will never forget this. And it was either a great thing, or in some cases a negative, sad, or traumatic thing. And I was true to my word. I never forgot so many of these things. And the other thing is that I always admired my dad's ability to tell compelling stories from his youth. And we had heard them over and over again over the years, and knew them and requested them and could repeat them and still sometimes think about them. But I knew early on that remembering what happened to you as a kid was going to be a positive thing and a helpful thing in terms of being a compelling storyteller. I just admired storytellers and in general, and my father in particular. And I knew it was going to be helpful for me to be able to be observant. And I also, the third thing I think is that I'm also gifted with a pretty unusual memory in that I'm very good at remembering a lot of the sensory details and a lot of the word for word dialogue that I encountered growing up.
That's amazing. And that's one of the things that makes the book so powerful. So you didn't keep notes along the way. You didn't keep a diary or a journal as you were growing up?
No, I didn't keep a journal growing up, but I did keep a running sort of tally of events and things that had gone well and things that had gone badly. And I was a storyteller for my family. I only saw my dad once a week. So I think a lot of times I had to recount a lot of the things that had happened to me during the week. And just to anybody who would listen, I was prepared with some stories, and my memory was always very, very strong. So I guess I did keep a journal. It just happened to be in my mind.
Yeah, very well said. A journal of your mind. Yeah, you should patent that and start selling it. But it wouldn't work for anyone else. When you were in fourth grade, you attended Jewish summer camp for the first time. What was that experience like?
It was supposed to be something where I was going to make friends, but it turned out to be a pretty lonely experience. I made one or two friends with other kids who were sort of marginalized, and it was an interesting phenomenon to sort of be marginalized amongst a group of people who are historically marginalized. And I connected with one kid named Mark Horowitz, and we were very close, and we sat together on the bus to things and at lunch and things. But it felt like everybody there was having the time of their life and making new friends and being embraced. And Mark and I were sort of observing, and I remember talking to him a lot about science fiction and fantasy. So it was really interesting. I've noted over the years that misfits generally cling to fiction of fantasy and comic books and things like that. It seems to be a sort of a dream fulfillment idea.
Mm-hmm. And that's the case for me. I consider myself a misfit and an outsider. You had one enemy in Jewish summer camp, a guy you called Kapler. Can you tell us about him?
Yes, he was my enemy because he was no more athletic than me or really charming or interesting than me. He was just a regular kid, but he had enormous confidence, and he made the softball team, and he starred in the camp play, and he won the sandcastle building contest. And I could not understand why this kid, who really did not have so much more going for him than I did, was so confident. And I was so shy and sad and felt anxious all the time, and so I just felt, although he had no idea that I was resenting him, I had built up so much resentment because I was losing all these things to this kid who I couldn't figure out why he felt so good about himself when I felt so lousy about myself.
Well, you had this great opportunity to publicly display your resentment during the experience the day you guys went to a zip line in the woods. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, yes. I didn't go on the zip line because I was too afraid. And Kapler, of course, was the first to go on. He was so energetic and was not afraid. He believed in himself. He went on there and he zipped down and he came down and he returned a hero. And everybody was so impressed by him, and they surrounded him and they said, "What was it like? And did you have a good time?" And I'll never forget what he said. And I knew at the moment I said, I'll never forget him saying this. He said, "Well, you learn so much about yourself." And he was 9 or 10 years old. And I just remember thinking, well, that is the phoniest. He copied that. He heard that on a commercial for Outward Bound or from an astronaut or something. And he decided to say this, and everybody oohed and aahed. And I said to him, I said, "Kapler, why do you have to be so preachy? You sound like a commercial." And he was not fazed by being called out by that. He didn't really care. And people looked at me like I was an ogre and a jerk. And it blew up in my face, but I couldn't resist. I was so turned off by his bravado and his false confidence. Well, maybe it wasn't false, but also his pretentiousness, I guess.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's one of my favorite stories in Misfit, and I have lots of favorite stories in there. Well, thank you. Besides writing about your childhood, you also write some very powerful passages about your battle with depression in 2017. And of course, you explored these. You were very honest about these in your great Netflix special, The Great Depression. Why did you decide to include these passages?
I think it was important to see and understand why a person at 46 years old at the time was scrutinizing and analyzing this time period of his life. And what happened in 2017 was, after being treated in the hospital, I was very concerned about my ability to continue to earn a living, because I was not able to perform as a comedian. And so I moved back to my mother's house, where I had grown up, and actually into the bed that I grew up in. And a lot of people would say that the lowest point would be being in the psych ward, but for me, it was actually moving back into my mother's house. It was really a stark contrast to my life in Manhattan. So I moved back there, and I was seeing a lot of the places that I had grown up with, experiencing a lot of the feelings I had grown up with. Also, I was intersecting with a lot of the people I had grown up with, because a lot of the people were still living in that neighborhood. Either they had bought their parents' house or they had moved nearby. So it was just this sort of, I guess, hurricane of nostalgia and reminiscing. And it brought back a lot of the things that I feared, but was now overcoming, and a lot of my trauma and a lot of my worldview had been developed when I was young. So I felt early on it needed to be clear why this 46-year-old man was spending so much time analyzing kindergarten through 12th grade. And so I thought this was a really good device to make sense of that.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. And you mentioned going back in time, and that brings me to my next question. I especially like the passage about your time travel fantasy, and I'd like to have you read this one paragraph.
There's long been a delusion involved in my depression that makes me fantasize about time travel. I daydream that I can go back in time and consciously enjoy the times when I felt better, and avoid all the pitfalls and missteps that I believe have doomed me to the state of mind I am trapped in.
That's a very powerful paragraph. And I wonder, does that kind of tie in? Because I have this feeling that I struggle with depression a lot, and I have this problem with being in the moment, because I'm always regretting the past and dreading the future. Is that kind of what you're talking about with the time travel fantasy?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sorry you have to deal with this. It's so painful, but I find that a lot of times, especially when I'm in the thick of a depressive episode, I go back over my life with a red pen and try to edit it and think, well, if I had made this decision, or if this person hadn't betrayed me, or if I had just stuck it out with this thing, I would have been making this different choice. And it's something that is really, I don't know that it's an official symptom of depression, but it is a symptom of my depression and a lot of depression, where you have so much guilt and regret, and it hijacks your brain with ruminations and this overall malaise of regret and guilt. And I found that it was soothing sometimes to spend time in that area of nostalgia and thinking back on things. And yet it was not therapeutic. It was not helpful time in my life.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm sorry you had to go through that, and thank you for your empathy on my behalf. Yeah, your depression has been in remission for 6 years. What have these last 6 years been like for you?
They've been easier than any other six-year period in my life. It's just you know from depression that one of the more insidious aspects of it is it just makes day-to-day life much harder. It's harder to walk upstairs. It's harder to get out of bed. It's harder to make breakfast. It's harder to keep commitments to meet people and be on time for things. It's just, that's one of the hardest things to accept about depression, is that these things that you loved are no longer bringing you pleasure or comfort.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about your depression returning?
I don't give it too much energy in terms of the likelihood. My psychiatrist said it becomes ever more unlikely that you'll have a relapse the further you get away from your last episode, and 6 years is a really long time. So I feel like my recovery is durable, and I have a lot of rituals, and there are a lot of fail safes that I've sort of installed over the years to keep me from falling too low. But I'm one of the fail safes is that I'm ever vigilant for any signs of reduction in my mood.
Gary Gulman, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s. It's a very funny and very poignant book.
Oh, Doug, it was such a delight talking to you, and thanks so much. And I hope we get to intersect in person in the future.
That was Gary Gulman. He's the author of the memoir, Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s. Find out more about Gary and Misfit at WPR.org/beta.
He always loved the New Yorker from the time he was in high school, and I think he got his subscription in college, and he has every issue of the New Yorker that he ever received in leather-bound editions in his New York offices.
Coming up, critic Matt Soler-Seitz joins us to talk about Wes Anderson's homage to the New Yorker, The French Dispatch. We'll try to make it sound like we did it on purpose. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.